Okay, this is the review session of Monday, May 8th, 2006, HDFS 60. Welcome to all of you listening on the web. All right. Now, the question about the format.
What is the format?
Of the review session or the exam? I interrupted you and you went on to say exam. The format of the exam. What would you like it to be? What do you want on it?
Multiple choice.
How many? About 50? More or less? What? A word bank. I don't know the term. Oh, the word, fill in the blanks, you've got the words here, it's just match the right answer. No, I wouldn't do that. So, because I heard several people object, so I wouldn't do it. We did that already, right?
Yeah.
With the definitions on the eco exam. Okay, so multiple choice, what else would you like? Easy short answers. Maybe something that gives you a little vignette. And then asks you some questions that are relatively easy because you know all this stuff. Okay, we'll do some of those.
Like in the eco exam, right? Like that whole thing. Okay.
Yeah. Except that... I just have to make sure it's working. I don't trust it. Yes, like on the eco exam... But there might be some wrinkles, some variations on that. The potential is that it might give you a little vignette and then ask you how you might alter somebody's ecosystem, you know, to improve the mesosystem or something. So there might be some application questions that would ask you to think beyond what is to what could be. I like those. But I'm not sure yet because I don't have to have the exam done until 8 in the morning, so why rush? And then the other thing you'd probably like is some short essays. Which means the questions are just a sentence or two and we give you about half a legal size sheet to write on. So you have to practice writing small and organize your answer, outline it, think about what you really need to say. For those of you who were in five, that kind of format. But yes? Yes, if we give you essays, we'll ask you to write a selection of them. And usually what I find is that four fits on a legal size sheet, both sides, and so asking you to write three of them cuts down the work and gives you some choice and lets you hope that the choice would let you drop the one question that you didn't know anything about. I must share a little personal experience about choices on exams. I had a course in college that had 22 books the semester, 3 credit course, one, you know, just a regular course, but had 22 books. And I'm still figuring out what that course was about. I'm getting there. But 3 of the books were called The Logic of Symbolic Forms. How many of you have read it? 3-volume. Ernst Cassirer, a French or Swiss philosopher, and they were humongous and dense, so I didn't read them. And you know what the professor did? He gave us choices on the exam. It was all essay exam, and he gave us choices, but there was no way you could avoid writing about Ernst Cassirer. And somehow I had missed that this was his favorite philosopher And if I had learned that at the beginning of the course, I would have read them, but I didn't. So I didn't do as well on the exam as I might have done had I read Kassira. Because reading it wouldn't have meant that I understood anything, so it might not have helped. I still don't understand Kassira, and I have read him. Okay, anyway. That's my sob story. And you see, these traumatic experiences in college will stick with you well into your 60s. You'll still be remembering HDFS 60 if it's traumatic. It's not going to be traumatic. Julie said, should we make it a little bit harder than last year? And I said, are we any smarter? She said, no, so we won't make it any harder. Not intentionally, anyway. Okay, what else would you like to know? Those are, as far as I can recall, the only three kinds of questions on the exam. The multiple choice, the short answer problem kinds of things. Yes? Equal. I actually don't know. The question is it more Bronfenbrenner or is it more reading lecture? It's hard to answer that because those two overlap. So it all has to do with developology and therefore Bronfenbrenner. And when I ask questions about the reading, they are often directly related to Bronfenbrenner. So it does cover just about everything. Yeah.
Are you
It doesn't stress details of the readings, but it does require that you know generally what the message was, the gist, as we call it, what the author's basic points are. And if you can boil those down to two or three basic points for most authors, you can get it. But then the other use of the readings is to take something directly from them and ask you to interpret it using Bronfenbrenner. And that I could take from anything. In fact, I was playing around with, you get a little crazy making exam questions and I write more than I can use and some of them are kind of funny. So I was thinking of song lyrics to interpret Bronfenbrennerianly. And it was kind of fun. I was thinking about, Will You Still Love Me When I'm 64? Beatles. I was thinking, what does it say about dyadic relationships? This is an important question in our household because I turned 64 this summer. So I keep asking my wife. She's reserving judgment. She's never known me 64, so she doesn't know whether she's going to love me at 64. She says she'll try. That's all I can ask. Yes?
For the questions about the readings, are you going to... We don't have to know the exact names of the authors.
No, I do things like... in her article on the future of marriage, Hodder says... I give you both the title and or at least the topic and the name. So you can remember, I don't remember who Hodder was, but there was an article on the future of marriage. And I'm actually, I'm toying around with seeing if I could go through and get a decent score on the exam without having done any of the reading whatsoever. It always...
No, I've read stuff. I've read stuff, I just don't read it. So okay. If you can pass it without having read stuff,
I keep writing these questions, and Julie's writing them too, and you keep thinking, you know, if you just know Bronfenbrenner, it doesn't really matter who wrote this, because it illustrates a whatever. It doesn't matter who wrote it. It doesn't matter whether I read it, as long as I know Bronfenbrenner and have a basic background of the English language and maybe the social sciences a little bit. But I'm watching for that. I wouldn't bank on it as a strategy, but I am interested in the idea. The best way to study for this exam at this point. You have 24 hours minus 17 minutes. I would suggest that you use 8 of those hours for sleeping. I would use 1 of those hours for exercise. I would use at least 1 hour for 3 good meals. A little sunshine for vitamin D. I would skim my notes and the outline and I would reread my paper 5. You can't read 6 because I have them. And I would ask, do I have a pretty good grasp of how the ecosystem works? And could I tinker with some part of the ecosystem in a way that would be consistent with Bronfenbrenner to make it more developmentally facilitating? Yeah. The notion of goodness of fit comes from what? Okay, Chess, Thomas, and Birch, and they're writing about temperament. And the notion of temperament is that kids aren't all the same. And they come not all the same. They have different temperaments. Honig talks about their research too a little bit. Galinsky talks about it. Honig says, says that while there's a little bit of question about what it is, most researchers agree that it's probably genetically based, it's biological, and nobody doubts that kids have their own temperaments and you probably can't change those very much. So that's one of the big ideas about children. It seems to be pretty, people have different ways of describing it, but there seems to be a pretty general consensus that kids are not all the same, and you can describe the differences, and some of us are, I think Honig uses the term triggery. I like that, triggery, boom, boom. Reactive, and Kagan looks at shyness. We didn't talk about him, but so if kids come at you different, then what's goodness of fit about? What's the challenge if kids come in different flavors?
Adjusting to them.
Okay, so it's the fit between what and what? The parents. And the child, and specifically what? Okay, it's about transactions, and that's one of the reasons that I think it's important to think about. But where's the fit? What's supposed to fit? I'm sorry, the
parent's temperament and the child's temperament together.
Okay, the child's temperament particularly. And not really the parent's temperament. How they react and what they expect. Expectations and really the transactions, their activities, but particularly their expectations, what they're trying to get the child to do. And the argument that Chess and Thomas make in the chapter that you have is that the child's not going to voluntarily say, oh, I'm 6 months old and I'm a difficult baby, and this is stressing my parents out, so I probably need to see if I can become easier. That's not going to happen. The child's temperament is the child's temperament. And while there's some argument about whether you can moderate it or modify it later in life, most of us argue that you can change the way you interpret it, but you're going to have to work with it. But what is changeable in Chess, Thomas, and Birch's view is the parents' expectations. And because they're the grown-ups, they're the ones who are supposed to be changing their expectations. They can't change their temperaments, but they can change their expectations and shape the transactions that they have so that they fit with what the child is likely to be able to do. So Chess, Thomas, and Birch, and that chapter comes from their book, and the title is important, Your Child is a Person. And as they introduce that book, not particularly in the chapter you have, but generally the book is about the fact that kids are different. And you have to accept that. You have to acknowledge that and study it and figure out what you can do, what are appropriate expectations for your child if your child has different temperament than you expected. And that's why I've stressed the Gerber baby. And the Gerber baby looks like it would be always happy. I was at the doctor's office this afternoon, that's why I was late with my mother. And there was this wonderful 6-month-old little boy and with his daddy. And it's the kind of kid who looks at you and he goes way across the room. I know I'm funny looking, it's okay. So you mug back, and this kid is standing on his daddy's knees and he's going like this, and he just lights up the whole room. And you know, strangers come by and look at him, and he goes, and you figure, okay, this is an easy kid. He didn't, not a fuss, not a squall. His daddy moved him around a bit. They went in, they came back, and the kid was still that way, but it looked to me like he'd been crying. And so I asked the dad, we'd had a conversation before, so I said, immunization? Yeah, and tongue depressor. And how long did he cry? Three squawks. And then he was right back to, he's going to be an easy kid. A kid like that who doesn't worry about things and recovers very quickly and is very sociable is likely to be a really easy kid. Dad's got an easy job. You get another kid would have still been screaming about the shot and the tongue depressor, would have been apprehensive about somebody coming along. And we don't always get the Gerber babies. In fact, probably a little less than half of kids are the Gerber babies. The rest of us get the other ones. And if we treat them as if they're going to be the Gerber babies, we're going to be upset. We're going to be upset with them. They're going to be upset. We're going to be asking them to do things that they can't comfortably do. And the transactions between us are going to be difficult. They're going to be full of conflict. And so Chess, Thomas, and Birch are arguing that It's the parent's responsibility to make that good fit. And as child psychiatrists and pediatricians, what they had seen in their practice that led them to this was when there's a bad fit, you can see it. And the kid is getting worse and worse. Now, let me generalize about that a little bit. Temperament is one of the things that I've stressed, and you've got the transaction with the child. The notion of the transaction between the parent and the child is comfortable because that's what Galinsky is about. Right? It's not specifically about the child's temperament in Galinsky. It's about the fact that as the child grows, the child is going to be doing different things. And as the child is doing different things, the parents are going to have to adjust again to what the child is able to do, what the child presents. And her whole book is an elaboration of how that transaction continues to evolve dynamically across all of childhood. That's what the stages are about, coping with the changes in the child. We didn't talk much about gender, but if you're thinking about children, they come in at least two genders, two sexes, then they, most of them, and then they diversify that as they grow up and become all kinds of males and females and in-between kids. But parents have expectations, and they create transactions with the sex of the child. Just simply knowing whether it's a boy or girl, or thinking you know, changes the way parents behave. And as we look at the development of gender, and this goes beyond, but you can generalize this about any characteristics of children. If you think about how gender develops, parents can make kids really stereotypically male or female. Now, the boys that don't cry and the girls that always wear pink and don't like to sweat. Or parents can create a different kind of transaction with kids that leads them to have boys that do cry happily and sadly, and like to sweat, and can understand feelings, and girls who also like to sweat, and who are strong and fearless, and rock climbing, free climbing on half moon, half dome, I mean. Yeah. So, the crucial element in this research and the notion of goodness of fit is that the transactions are in part influenceable by the parents. Kids aren't going to change their sex, but they're going to adapt to the transactions to some degree and become a different kind of boy or a different kind of girl. I could go on, but I'll stop there and see what other questions you have. What do you do while you're engaging in transactions with your parents as a child? This is not a trick question. What are you doing in the transactions? And this goes back to the first couple of lectures, talking about assumptions. I would go back and look at... Right. You're passing something back and forth in the transactions. And what are you doing as a result of that? You're creating a relationship. And what's going on in your brain? You're developing. Thank you. It wasn't a trick question. What you're engaging in when you're engaging in activities and transactions with your parents and other people is you're doing those proximal processes. Those are the proximal processes. Activities and relationships and reading and talking and playing and learning games and all of those things. The point of those proximal processes is that they lead you to change what you understand. They are the stuff of which you create your understanding of the world. That's the Piagetian and the constructivist point of view. It's a basic assumption here that the whole reason all of this stuff about transactions, one of the main reasons why it's important, is that it's in my transactions with other people, particularly people, that I develop my understanding of the world and my expectations for it. And as I do that, I am developing in Bronfenbrenner's sense. Remember Bronfenbrenner's definition of development? Off the top of your head? You can do this. The process. The process of acquiring, constructing a more valid and differentiated view of the ecosystem you live in, or the ecological environment, I think is his phrase, is basically the ecosystem, and skills and by tomorrow you should be able to rattle off some version of that, especially if you're going to be in 161 in the fall or anything else I teach the rest of your life, my life. It's in those transactions and in the molar activities, and particularly the joint activities. Remember all of Bronfenbrenner's propositions in the articles about discovering what parents do and what families do, where he boils all of the social sciences about families down to 7 propositions in one article. It really is very simple. And this is what he's saying. He's saying that it's in the activities and the relationships. He doesn't use the word transactions as much. It's in those that you develop your understanding of yourself and the world and your skills and motivation to change it and to interact with other people. And you need particular kinds of relationships and activities to do that in a healthy fashion. You will do it. It just may not be healthy. It may not be very good development. You will do it in an abusive relationship. But what you will learn there is not going to take you very far. And as you're doing that development through all of those transactions in the family, particularly in the family, you're establishing the view of the world and the skills that you're going to take into every other setting that you ever go into, and then you're going to modify them in every other setting that you go into, because school is going to be a little different from home. But you're going to bring into school what you had at home. That's your expectation. And then you're going to modify it, or not. And then farther along, you're going to take what you transacted and the activities that you engaged in with your parents And you're going to grow up, and you're going to take that view of the world and those skills into your partnering relationships. So what you're learning at home in the family is what you're going to take into being a partner. Like it or not, that's going to be part of it. And then you can start modifying and adapting to the particular person that you're trying to partner with. So again, in your dating relationships, and this brings us kind of full circle, in your dating relationships, you're going to be applying what you learned at home. And each person is going to do that, so it's going to be different. They're going to be bringing different things, and then they're going to create a transaction. And activities that reflect the transactions that they had in previous settings and relationships, and that reflect their view of the world and the skills that they learned. So if one of them has a view of the world that says there's really no difference between men and women, we're both equal, we need to be in an equal relationship, there's nothing that women do that men can't do and vice versa, so there's no traditional view here, and the other one comes from a very different worldview that says, yeah, no, women can't do this and men have to do this. Now, then they've got some adjusting to do because their transactions are going to reflect those differences and they're going to have conflict. So that's why the emphasis on the transactions between parents and children and their shape, and the activities that parents do, because that's the stuff of your development. And as you're developing, then you're setting the foundation for what you take into other relationships and other activities. You knew that. You can say that on the exam, right? In your own words. Questions about that? Can you fill in the details? Some of the places I would look, Honig is talking about raising happy, competent, happy, confident. What else is? What? Achieving. That's it. Yeah, I knew there was. There's some reason I was rejecting, that I was repressing that word. I wouldn't use achieving, but I like her anyway. The issue for me is competent. I'm not sure you need to achieve a lot in life, but it would be helpful if you have good relationships and can do something that pays the rent and have fun that doesn't hurt other people. Honig is talking about lots of different approaches, both within families and in schools and in society, to adjust, to change the transactions and the expectations and the activities to make it possible for kids to develop as well as possible. So one way to think about her articles, she's got a cookbook. There are all different kinds of things that parents and teachers and society could be doing. And while I was reviewing that, looking for exam questions, I made up an exercise for next year. You can come back and take it if you want, to create a team of people to have them go through that whole article and pick out everything in it that is talking about changing dyads and everything in it that's changing molar activities everything in it that's talking about the mesosystem, because she's covered the whole ecosystem in there. I just think it'd be fun to take it apart that way and see if you could translate it. Bronfenbrenner's two articles boil it down to specific propositions about the nature of the transactions and the activities, and those are really important as ways of thinking about how do you set things up. So it would be helpful if you could take any of his propositions and illustrate them. Here's an example of what I would do in my family if I wanted to put this proposition to use. Other questions?
What would be the kind of example you could give for like short answer questions?
The short answer things would be like the ones on the eco exam, but shorter typically. I might give you an example of a family with three or four people in it and some kind of issue they were dealing with. So then I might say, so what kind of change might you make in the child's molar activities or in the child's mesosystem, or how would you try to change the relationship between the parents and child?
And then also you remember we have to take like three or four, what kind of things that they
need to do with that? Yeah, I probably would. Now I'll have to go back and look if I have specified and what would be one way or what would be two ways.
No, just because of your bell size, but it's going to be pretty often when we take a little bit of like four questions.
Oh, no, I won't do those.
Oh, you won't?
Yeah.
Oh, so the only kind of short answer would be like a story thing? Or
yeah, be like the story thing, not like the which of the following would you do. So it would be really fun to convert those to multiple choice questions.
Yeah,
which of the following would you do to make a mesosystem more? You're shaking your head. Okay. I'm sorry. Go back to the beginning.
Okay. Could you also try to dramatize the short answer for the stories and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
But there could also be other questions that would be, you know, like extreme, you know, and that's like questions that we would have to try out our answers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of stuff would you ask about? Is it like related?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, well, I don't know. Just like some stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. I would be comfortable asking almost anything in that realm. Okay. No. I, off the top of my head, something specific? Yeah, it would depend on the content of what I was asking about. So, but I would expect you to be able to think about the whole ecosystem for any particular setting or any particular relationship. Yeah. Is a developmental dyad the healthiest kind of dyad? What would the other candidates be?
Well, a dyad that didn't have balance or
philosophy.
Mm-hmm. I didn't prefer to answer my question.
Yeah, well, I was just making sure there wasn't something else that I had described, particularly in the book, but a developmental dyad from a developmental perspective would be the best kind. But you could embellish that. too. And developmental dyad specifically refers to the balance of power, the joint activities, in it, the reciprocity and the affect. But you could embellish that by suggesting that the person occupy a variety of roles. And so this person lives a complex life and engages the less developed person or the developing person in a variety of roles. So you could say that, yeah, you could make it even more important in the kid's life. But Bronfenbrenner's thinking about it just from that one set of criteria. And I like that. That's a nice question. So I'm trying to put it in long-term memory so that when I get down to the office, I can write another multiple choice question. Let's see if it stays there. Would you email me later and say, remind me? Are there things you hope we don't ask about?
What kind of things do you ask about birth order?
Birth order. There's a good question. What would you ask? What would you expect me to want you to understand about birth order?
Maybe just the basic traits that the firstborn has and the secondborn.
Okay. Well, the basic characteristics of firstborns and middles and lasts, yeah. And what else would be important? Yeah. What parents might do? How parents might contribute to that?
Their gender.
I'm sorry?
Their gender.
Their gender? And how does all of that connect to this particular course? And what kinds of transactions you can have if you're the firstborn or only or the lastborn? Because somehow you have to get from, and this was the question that I had projected at one point, you have to get from the fact of birth order to the consistency that the researchers find that allow them to say things like firstborns are bleh, or middles tend to be bleh, or only children. You've got to get from the fact that the child occupies that particular position in the family to why that position in the family leads people to have some similar characteristics that allow you to generalize about birth order. So you have to get to what's going on in the family for the firstborn, the secondborn, the thirdborn. What are they experiencing? And the way Bronfenbrenner lets you interpret that is that they each have different roles. They also each have different dyads. And the power and reciprocity in those dyads are different. The firstborn has dyads only with children who are less well developed. The only has dyads with grown-ups within the family. Never has somebody who's younger. The only child is in that position. So what Bronfenbrenner lets you do, the way I apply it, is to think about the microsystem that the children are experiencing. And Bronfenbrenner's definition of the microsystem is that it's the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities experienced by the developing person. And each of those developing persons in the family occupies a different sibling position. and because of that position, experiences a different microsystem, a different set of relationships and roles than anybody else in the family. The only people who have the same one are twins. And even theirs can be different, but twins are in a unique kind of position. So the microsystem that they're experiencing is influencing the nature of the transactions that they can have, the dyads that they can experience, and those are influencing their view of the world and their skills. So sibling order, birth order position affects your development by affecting that whole experience that you have in the family. And what's common to firstborns is the nature of the transactions and dyads that they can have. What's common to lastborns is the babies, is that they all have that similar position. Thank you for that. So the bottom line in all of this is that you can explain what happens, but it's a developmental process that fits into the ecosystem that the particular people are experiencing. And what you've learned to do is analyze that ecosystem so that you can speculate on almost any kind of microsystem or mesosystem and figure out how it's impacting the people in it and how to improve it, or if you're diabolical, how to make it worse. I won't ask a question, I think. I probably won't ask a question about how to make life worse for somebody. But it's an interesting exercise, because you could probably design a really diabolical way to grow up that would make sure that you ended up being schizophrenic and homicidal. Probably. I probably will ask questions about divorce, yeah. Just making sure, just reminding me. Yeah. What kind of questions would I ask about divorce? Okay, the best way to have a divorce, if you got to have one. The effects having a good one might have, the effects having a bad one might have. Might ask a simple question about using a developmental perspective to describe the changes, to describe that process of divorce, you know, what's happening from perhaps the child's point of view. Another one that occurs to me is that Bronfenbrenner makes an interesting set of statements in one of his articles in talking about single-parent households. And essentially, he says that kids are at all kinds of increased risk, emotionally, cognitively, academically. I forgot what else he put in there. But he said basically kids that grow up in one-parent households, regardless of why it's a one-parent household, are likely not to develop as well as kids who are in two-parent households. It's a pretty bald and bold statement on his part. And I can imagine some people parenting alone taking umbrage at that, being annoyed by his conclusion that they're not able to do as good a job. But the question that occurs to me is why? If you're Bronfenbrenner and you're thinking about it developmentally and you think about a household with one parent in it, what would be the characteristics of the microsystem in that household that might make it reasonable that kids would have increased risk or develop less well. So what you would be wanting to think about then is the roles and the relationships and the activities and perhaps the mesosystem connections and support that would apply to make a one-parent household different from a two-parent household. Because if you see those differences between kinds of households, practically everything you've read has suggested that you ought to be able to explain them, or at least come up with hypotheses about why they would be different. What would be the risks in a one-parent household? So, yeah, I'll ask about the views. I would love to ask some questions that I probably won't, but as I said, you get a little crazy when you're writing exam questions and think of things. I really like the question about polygyny and polyandry, multiple spouses. Yeah. Why would kids be better off with four parents in the household? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'd be fun to think about it. Yeah. I started to go a different direction going there. What else do you wish you knew about? Brains full? Yes.
I just have a question. What percent of this exam, what is it worth? Like, what percent out of our total grade?
How many points on the final, and what does that do to compare to everything else? The final is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 points. As I said, probably about 50 multiple choice at one point each, and then the other stuff will probably end up being close to 50. I don't want to be held to that. It's you know, anywhere between 90 and 110. But 'cause, you know, I get attached to questions. I really like them. I don't want to throw them out, and I don't. So it's a very emotional experience. For me as well as you. And what do we have in the way of total points so far? I actually don't know. With all the exercises, the eco exam, the possible maximum you could have at this point is something like 160. I don't know. It's probably in the order of 160 or 170. I think the top score probably at this point is probably about 150. I'm kind of guessing, because the exercise sixes are worth 40 points and they're not in there yet. So I haven't seen the distribution. But that would be the range. So the bottom line for that is, if the total ends up being 260 possible points, roughly, then 10/26 or 5/13 of it are the final. Whatever that turns out to be, 30%, something like that. It had never occurred to me to ask that question. The the way the course is built is intentional, that it starts off with things that aren't worth a whole bunch of points, and then they get bigger because what you're doing is more complex through the course. So each of the assignments was worth more than the previous ones, and then the final, because it really does pull everything together and tap the whole semester, is the biggest chunk of possible points. And that means that if you do really well on the final, you're pretty much guaranteed, if you've done the other stuff, you're pretty much guaranteed of getting a pretty good grade.
Is it possible 158?
Okay. That was close. Now I'm going to go check. For what? The top you could get on the eco exam was 53.
So it's 100.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. Okay. So if it's 158 and this is 100, then it's about 30%. There was another, did you have a question? Ah, oh yes, dating and relationships, and yeah, characteristics of a good dyad, a good relation. And every time you see the word relation, you should be thinking affect, reciprocity, and power. Thank you, Joanna. Yeah. And every time you see the word microsystem or household or setting, you should be thinking not all that stuff. Roles, relationships, and activities. The pattern thereof. Yeah, the brainwashing is not quite complete, I see. We get there. You're going to use this stuff all summer long. You're going to dream about microsystem and macrosystem. And it's going to hit you at incredibly random moments. And you're going to catch yourself thinking developologically, and you're going to chuckle. And people are going to say, what? And then you're going to try to explain it to them, and Mary Beth, you're not.
Do you grade from the highest point possible or from the highest in the class point earned, and then everybody's grade after that?
It's just the points, just the ones you got. So I don't pay any attention, actually, to what the maximum possible was. I'm just interested in what you got. Do I ever scale? Why would one scale? Actually, what I'm doing is scaling. What I'm doing makes scaling unnecessary because it's a direct competition between students. And it says the people who get the highest number of points get an A, and it goes down. So scaling is only necessary when you make up an exam and then or a system in which you say that to get an A you have to get 90 plus points. And that is a totally untenable assumption. And people have to scale because they discover that because their exam was stupid, you know, the highest points were 20 or 70. And so you're giving everybody C's, including the people who did best in the class. So you have to scale to wipe out what you originally said. And what you end up doing is what I do. But there is no rationale for 92 points required for an A, unless you actually do the research that is necessary to create exams over time with enough people taking them so that you can validate the assumption that you're making. And so you literally craft an exam that 5 or 10% of people will get 92 plus on. And there are whole courses taught about psychometrics. And everybody who uses the 90 plus or the 80 plus, everybody in high school and college, everybody with very few exceptions is doing something that is psychologically and psychometrically invalid. And if they ever tried to do that in a psychology course, they'd get killed. Yeah. And they'd fail. Because there is absolutely no rationale for that. Unless you have done semester after semester creating exams on your content and the way you teach so that you can actually create a test that has a particular percentage of people getting 90 plus. There's no way I'm going to do that work. I can't do it. So I just start off scaling. The top scores get A's. And if somebody can come up with a better and simpler system, I'll use it, but nobody ever has. So, and they won't before I retire, so I'm okay. There are other ways to do it. And I have used other ways, if you're curious. I've taught courses in which we could define what was expected to get an A and then let people do that and keep doing it until they do what's expected if they want an A. And that may mean, for example, in one course we used to teach in a way that you had to get a certain score on multiple choice exams to get a C. You had to get a C plus. You had to get a certain number of points on essay exams. And then if you wanted an A, you had to do those plus an A quality term paper. You know what an A quality term paper requires? Yeah. It's got to be really, really good. But the way we did that course was that you could take those exams over again if you didn't get to the level you wanted. You could write the term paper over again. You could keep revising it until it became an A paper. And it was interesting to see how people did in that system. It works pretty well, but it's an incredible amount of work for the instructor. So it only works if you have a lot of instructors or a small class. I can't have term papers in here for everybody who wants an A. Or I'd be reading 40, 50, 60 term papers and grading them, and every one that wasn't an A would be turned back, and then you'd have to revise it, and then I'd have to read it again and grade it again. And I'd be buried. But in a small class, you can do that. So there are other ways to do it. They're just not particularly practical. But every time you have a course where somebody says you got to get 92% of the points for an A, ask them what the psychometric justification for that is. They'll decide that you're a wise ass and flunk you. But it's an appropriate question. On that note, we have veered so far off the topic that we'll come back to it if you have questions. Otherwise, get a good night's sleep. Don't talk to your significant others. I didn't give my usual warning. This is the day that people decide to break up with each other. No. Don't even talk to your significant others unless they're going to be really supportive. And we'll see you tomorrow.